Hi, Blogging Heads viewers. This is Daniel Strauss of Woodruff & Strauss, and today I have the esteemed Michael Warren of the Weekly Standard here to talk 2016 and the GOP side, because ironically I don't really know very much about the Dem side, but we're going to talk about Hillary too, but mostly, because there are also 17 candidates.
17. If you can name them all, you
can
win a
you
prize,
name them
actually.
All?
Yes, I,
do
I
it.
Can't think.
Do it.
All right, here we go. Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Marco Rubio, Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum, Jim Gilmore, George Pataki. Get those out of the way.
Those are the hard ones.
Ben Carson. Did I say Donald Trump already? I think
no,
I did.
Didn't say it. No, you didn't.
Okay, so Donald Trump.
Okay.
Carly Fiorina.
Okay.
Rick Perry.
Uh-huh.
Rick Santorum. Did I say Rick Santorum?
Oh, shit. I don't think you did. Keep going.
I don't think it did. So Rick Santorum. Hold on. Bobby Jindal.
Bobby Jindal.
There's no time limit on this.
No.
Hold on. Where are we at now?
You're at 13. You have four to go.
I have four to go. Okay, here we go. Rand Paul.
Uh-huh.
Ted Cruz, of course. I forget Ted Cruz.
Two more, Michael.
Two more. Hold on. It's not Mark Everson. I don't think we can count him. Who am I forgetting? Well, shoot, I've just set myself up for failure, haven't I? John Kasich, thank you.
Okay, you got one more.
I just wrote a piece on him. I don't know why I forgot him. And one more. Hold on. No helping here.
Okay.
I said Rubio. I got all the – oh, Lindsey Graham, of
Lindsey
course.
Lindsey Graham.
Very
impressive.
Good old Lindsey. Thank you. Thank you very much.
23 candidates. Well done, Michael. I am impressed. I didn't think you'd get there. I'm going to start asking some of our campaign reporters here if they can name all 17. And Mark Everson, by the way, that's the tax guy?
That's the guy from the IRS.
Yeah.
One time I wrote a blog post kind of making fun of him, which is probably a little mean, just kind of saying, like, Mark Everson, who is that? And I got an onslaught of email from him and his campaign staff about how could you forget Mark Everson, and I promptly forgot Mark Everson.
Does he have multiple campaign staffers?
Did you say
Chris Christie? You said Chris Christie, right?
Oh, I didn't say Chris Christie. See, I think I said Rick Santorum twice. So I really see, yes, Chris Christie.
How shit. Well, wow. Fuck. Okay, well, I got to warn you, because I don't usually read the comments on anything I write, but I read the comments on Blogging Heads, and they're going to skewer both of us for that.
Wow. For getting the elephant in the room. So.
Oh, man. He tells it like it is.
I kid. I love Chris.
No. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, like, you know, how can we forget Chris Christie? There's so much to say about him. Still, even more now.
Exactly.
You know? Jesus. So we were going to start off today. I don't know. I really liked how this started. How did you want to start off today? We were going to talk originally about John Kasich, but before that, we were going to talk about Scott Walker.
Right.
And the rise in what might be, I'm not ready to say fall, but some clear signs that the big honeymoon, the big gust from his big speech in Iowa is over. It's time to, like, get working. In the last few days, Walker has seen his polling decline in Iowa, which is not good timing because it's been during the Iowa State Fair. He released an Obamacare repeal plan. And I have seen, including at Politico, some stories about how there was a Wall Street Journal reporter who tweeted that her question was screened in the sort of wonky call that campaigns usually have when they're rolling out a policy plan. I have a friend at another publication who did not get an invite, which was kind of insane because he's a esteemed healthcare reporter.
Right.
And our Dylan Byers also wrote something about how Walker is not totally accessible. So this is potentially, you know, kind of troublesome. And during the last debate, Walker very heavily relied on his background as busting unions while Donald Trump was sucking all the air into the room, which is a common analogy for him. And I'm kind of fascinated by that. Anyway, so...
He's the vacuum candidate.
Yeah, he's the vacuum Donald candidate.
Yeah, look, I think the conventional wisdom is definitely moving... in the direction of saying that Walker is in trouble, or he's some people are even saying he's on his way out.
Yeah.
There's, I think, always an element of truth to the conventional wisdom, but just an element. I'm a little skeptical of those who are saying that Walker is on the decline, he's on the wane. He certainly has not helped himself in the last couple of weeks. Some of that's out of his control. I think Donald Trump, as you say, does suck the air out of the room. Walker didn't help himself much in that debate. He wasn't given that many opportunities to, I would say. I can't remember the exact timing of who got enough time to speak, but I remember thinking as I was watching that Walker's questions didn't give him, I think, a chance to shine. That's not an excuse for him. You know, right. He ought to be able to answer any question and use that. But I think he really kind of came out and it was more of the Walker that we expect in that closing statement where he talked about his record of accomplishment in Wisconsin. Look, I think that the Iowa polls are not great for him because Iowa is really key and really important for Scott Walker. But I'm a little skeptical that he's down and out in Iowa simply because Donald Trump has shot ahead. Walker has a really good organization in Iowa. It's not as big as Jeb Bush or Donald Trump, but he doesn't have as much money as them. And money doesn't win everything. As we remember from 2012, Romney threw a bunch of money in and almost won Iowa. Rick Santorum had basically no money and won that caucus barely. Mm-hmm. So I think Walker's still in a good position in Iowa. He really needs Iowa, I think, because if he doesn't win Iowa, he's not doing that great New Hampshire. I think he can probably he can't write New Hampshire off, but we can write it off for him. Yeah. And say he's probably not going to win. But he really needs the momentum from Iowa to do well in South Carolina and then in that SEC primary. He doesn't have a big foothold in the important states of that primary.
Those important states, actually?
I would say Georgia is
one of the biggest. Our chief politics editor is like very fascinated by this question and has brought up Tennessee and Georgia.
Tennessee and Georgia and Virginia is actually, even though it doesn't have an SEC school, is part of that SEC primary. And there are actually non-Southern states that have primaries that day as well. But I think Georgia and Tennessee, in terms of their influence within the party, the Southern element of the party is very important. I think Walker needs Iowa to give him a foothold there because he doesn't have it right now. I talked to someone yesterday who's very familiar with Georgia politics who said, look, right now it's Jeb versus Cruz in Georgia because Cruz has the sort of evangelical, sort of Main Street Republican vote and, sort of everything outside of Atlanta is Cruz country. Jeb is Atlanta, is sort of the money part of Georgia, which is it's a wealthy state, at least in Atlanta. So that is where Walker, I think, will struggle if he doesn't win Iowa. But it's still a long way away. He's got goodwill, Walker does, in Iowa. I'm not ready to count him out, but he's going to have to make some changes, or at least some something to help him maintain a level of enthusiasm there. We're starting to see that a little bit, but it's going to have to change.
So what do you think, I mean, beyond just sort of the mysterious up and down of the polls, what do you think is preventing Walker from just dominating? Or I because throughout this whole throughout the early months of the presidential race, I feel like I'm actually very impressed with Cruz, but
me too.
I feel like Walker has not clinched or is competing and losing the contest with Cruz about being the viable conservative candidate. And going in, Walker had the advantage because what's that phrase? Everybody hates Ted Cruz. People like Scott Walker and he has this Midwestern appeal, but I don't understand quite what is going on. Like, what is holding Walker back? My theory is that part of it is simply that he has depended a little too much on his background of bashing unions and the GOP is all about finding some kind of candidate who's the future and look forward in that way. And, you know, he wants to run on his record. And he hasn't been able to do that yet. But it's weird because Walker, it's Walker's region, right? People in the Midwest, I say as a Midwesterner, know who Scott Walker is.
Right. Yeah. I think on the one hand, Walker's record in Wisconsin is very good. Mm-hmm. If you're a Republican primary voter, you like what he's done.
Yeah.
So it's not unwise for him to talk about that and remind people of that. And it's a big part of why I still think he has so much goodwill among Republican primary voters, because unlike a lot of these other candidates, he can say, I've done something. He talks about being fighting back. Cruz can say that, and people, I think, would agree that he's a sort of a fighter, but the accomplishments haven't followed quite. And I do agree that sort of there is a sort of urge for Republicans to have some wins on the board,
right?
Have some points on the board, and Walker can point to that. I do think that you're right that he also needs to have a forward-looking agenda, and which is actually why I think the Obamacare speech this week, the Obamacare replacement plan that he announced this week, is important. It's an important part of that. I think if I were advising him, I would have said, why not get out of the gate with this, you know, right from the beginning with an Obamacare replacement. It's the one issue that has united Republican voters and Republicans across the country. And it's the one thing that's motivated. I mean, think about it. 2010 and 2014 were all about Obamacare, different elements of it. It's a motivating issue for Republicans. It's the singular issue, a domestic issue, I think, of our time for Republicans. And so Walker's got a plan. I think it's a good plan. I think it's the kind of plan Philip Klein at the Washington Examiner described it as pragmatic.
Did he? Pragmatic. Okay. I saw that Bill Kristol liked it. I didn't see that Phil. And Phil is the Republican or the conservative leaning heavyweight on Obamacare.
Yes.
Right?
He wrote a book on it. I trust Philip Klein on everything. He's a fantastic reporter and a fantastic sort of mind on healthcare, and he's followed kind of the detailed policy debates that have been happening in Republican circles. I think that a sort of serious replacement that doesn't do too much disruption. Because remember, one of the big Republican objections to Obamacare was that it was disruptive. Not just that it was bad and it was sort of introducing some government, a lot of government elements into the healthcare system, but that it was disruptive, and that's what we saw with people, you know, having their premiums go up or not being able to get it on the website. Mm-hmm. So I think that Walker's plan is a good start to that, sort of getting some institutional conservative and Republican voices on his side that will sort of maybe help donors feel a little more comfortable about where the campaign's going. I think that's a smart step. But it's just one step of the process. He's got a lot more to go.
I think you're right. I think this would have, like, especially early on when there was a great deal of enthusiasm, at least in D.C. and among the D.C. media elites toward Walker. If he had come out with this Obamacare replacement plan earlier, it would have been. I mean, of course, there's always the fear that discussing Obamacare might eclipse the overall message of the campaign. But I think you're right. I think, you know, people would look at the Obamacare plan and then say, oh, and Walker did all this other stuff. This is who we got to talk to. He's a thinker also.
Right.
I think it's, by the way, funny that Bobby Jindal is furious about this plan and is screaming, that's not the first plan. I came out with the first plan. You know, poor Bobby.
Yeah, it's a little desperate, right? But but look, Jindal has been on
a
different
fair
side of this debate. I would say there is a robust debate about what to do after Obamacare or with Obamacare. What should Republicans do with it? And Jindal's been I don't mean this pejoratively, but it's sort of an extreme side of the debate that says we got to scrap the whole thing and get rid of it. Mm-hmm. I think that speaks to his low poll numbers that he has, you know, that's his position, because I don't think it's a tenable position in a Republican primary. People don't like Obamacare in the Republican Party, but they also they want to get rid of it. And I think there's a feeling that something that's too extreme won't pass in the next Congress with the next president is problematic. So
let's talk about Ted Cruz and the SEC primary a second, because I think we both are in somewhat agreement or have the same sort of response to Cruz here, which is that I'm really impressed with how he's done and how he has sort of pivoted on Donald Trump's entrance into the race. And the thing that I've found most impressive in that is that I think he's sort of laying the groundwork for the what a lot of people assume is the post-Trump era of the campaign cycle, where Trump is out whenever, however that will be. And Cruz has made sure to campaign a lot in these SEC states. He has also picked out campaign chairs for these states who are very conservative and known as sort of firebrands in their state. Chris McDaniel, who we talked about in a previous episode, Lee Bright in South Carolina, what's his name in Oklahoma, the congressman who didn't run for Senate, but I was, because my predictions are always wrong.
Oh, Bridenstine.
Yeah, Jim Bridenstine, who is
the
darling of the far right. People
That's
love
right.
him. So Cruz is doing it's sort of like he's doing the infrastructure building that I think down the line is going to pay off very well, and he's got money. He doesn't have the most money, but he's doing. I'm really impressed with Ted Cruz.
I totally agree with that, and it's his best path, right? Is through the SEC primary states. Like, he's going to win Texas. I think there's no question about that. But picking up Oklahoma, Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia might be a little hard, but there's other states. I think Mississippi and Alabama.
So in all this, do you know? Yeah. I don't know too much about Bill Haslam, but it seems like in the SEC primary, that is the endorsement to get. He's a chairman of the RGA,
right?
And Tennessee's an important state. And didn't he go for the Medicaid or expansion?
Medicaid expansion.
He did.
I would not expect Bill Haslam to endorse Ted Cruz. Look, again, I think what you're seeing in Georgia is what you're going to see throughout the SEC primaries. I thought it was interesting, by the way, that in Alabama, Robert Bentley, Bob Bentley, the governor there, endorsed Kasich the other day. The kind of Kasich Jeb, and I think we're going to get to them later, but the kind of Kasich Jeb wing of the party is going to be a powerful element in these SEC primary states, the sort of establishment. I think Haslam will fall on that part of on that divide side of the divide. I don't know if the numbers are there. The money will be there, and sort of the institutional influence will be there, but the numbers will be, I think, more in Cruz's direction. I think you're absolutely right about the organization that Cruz is building, and politically as well, or sort of at the top level, everybody has been, I think, going after Cruz a little bit for saying, oh, he's not criticizing Donald Trump. How can he not be criticizing Donald Trump? Well, this is insane.
Right.
No, it's not insane. It's genius, actually, for him to sort of say out of one side of his mouth, I just don't think, I follow Reagan's 11th commandment that we should not criticize other Republicans, and I'm not going to do that to Donald Trump. On the other hand, he's made an entire career out of criticizing Republicans.
Yeah, and just like, no, I think it's right, and I think he's gotten away with this because, right now he's not criticizing Cruz, but 16 other candidates are criticizing Trump. So what else is there to say? There's no winning for Cruz to bash Trump with the rest of them. There's winning because he's probably going to be around after Trump is gone.
That's
if Trump is gone, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Trump will get the nomination. I don't know.
Unlikely, I think.
Well, why do we all say that? Okay, we're all so sure that Trump is going to like bow out, but I feel like every time people say Trump won't do something, he does it. And so, like, what makes I totally am with you, man. But like, I just don't know why I think that.
I had this conversation actually the other day. I was in a green room at one of the cable news outlets with Newt Gingrich, he was there. He wasn't on the phone or anything, so I just said, "What do you think about all this?" And he was talking about how Trump is just blowing everybody away and all these things. And I said, yeah, but you know, it's got to end. Yeah, how does it end here?
And he looked at me. Did he say fundamental? Did he say fundamentally? You know,
no, he didn't. He didn't say. No, it was much more conversational than
okay.
That. Thank goodness. But you know, I asked him. I said, how does this end? How does it end? And he said, why does it have to end? He says, everybody's saying it's going to end, but why does it have to? What's stopping him? And I kind of stopped and I thought, holy yeah, shit, he's right. You know, he's right.
There's nothing. There's no nothing reason.
But I do think that it wears thin a little bit. And I do think the polls kind of overestimate his support. People, it's cliche to say, but there's the celebrity factor that people say, yes, I love Trump because he's saying what he wants. And I also know him and I think he's funny or I think he's entertaining. I do think this is the importance of the early primary states. People like to bash Iowa and New Hampshire. Why do they get the say? But, you know, they are experienced in selecting candidates and winnowing the field. And I do think that they're serious about it as well. And I think there's a lot of energy and excitement for Trump. And he could go – he's already gone farther than I thought he would. But, you know, so we may be proven wrong. But I do think there is a sort of seriousness among Republicans that – we need to win in 2016. We've got to beat Hillary Clinton, and Trump is not the guy to do that. So,
I mean, that segues. That's a good way to conclude what we've been talking about so far, which is Cruz and Walker both want the Trump supporters. The contest also is to absorb those fans who are rabid and are saying, "I'm going to vote right now." I think a lot of Republican voters just aren't ready to say they don't know who they're going to vote for yet, and that'll change over time when the winnowing happens. But the Trump fans, we actually don't know if they're going to vote, because I think there's a fair argument to be made that these guys don't usually vote.
And they're not always, I should say, this has been shown in polling, they're not always sort of pulled from the traditional right-wing Tea Party, Cruz wing of the party. There's a lot of so-called moderates or people who have those views who probably don't vote in many elections anyway, who say they like Trump. And so I think the thing to always think about, particularly in this Republican primary where there's so many candidates, is the way that we think about candidates, you know, that, oh, well, Cruz occupies this realm and that's who votes for him. And that's generally true, but it's not always the case.
Right.
I've talked to voters who, you know, in places where they say, yeah, you know, I'm really thinking about, you know, whether it's Ted Cruz or Jeb Bush, I'm going to vote
yeah,
for.
Yeah, I actually, at a Trump event, I actually talked to someone who listed the guys he liked, and it was Kasich, Cruz, Fiorina, and Trump, which is bizarre to me. And he said, well, these guys are all anti-establishment guys from Washington, or anti-establishment outside of Washington. And I think that's the appeal to this sort of weird conglomerate who's looking at who likes Trump. Somehow.
Yes, totally. It's not predictable, and we get in our heads the way that things shake out, the way that voters think, and they don't always think the way we think they should. And that's probably a good thing.
Right. I really want to hit this topic now before we go on to serious stuff again. Marco Rubio, quarterback. on Monday, he was throwing the pigskin around with some kids in Iowa, in Ankeny, Iowa, I think the subdivision is called. And there's a video. There are two videos going around of him throwing the ball at another kid, and I think with the first video, he beans a kid in the head. He throws a spiral, and it doesn't go in the kid's hands, and he's stretching. He's going, this is like his Super Bowl moment.
Right.
This is he's on the Seattle Seahawks. It's the last few seconds. It's, you know, this is it. And he just completely missed it. It hits him on the head, and his head sort of snaps, and he's on the ground. It's hilarious. I watched it multiple times yesterday. We wrote it up. We got picked up on Drudge on this. And I don't think Drudge has anything against Rubio, does he? I don't know.
It's kind of hard. The Kremlinology that goes on in Drudge world, you know, is kind of.
I think Matt just thought it was hilarious.
It was funny. And the second video is, I think he was handing it off He may have passed it, but I think it was a handoff to another kid who was even smaller, and it was it was so adorable. And the kid just kind of runs off in the grass, and it just kind of face plants and boom, hits the ground. The ball snaps out, and I think Mark Halperin said it was the cutest fumble he'd ever seen. although I think there's some disagreement about whether his knees were on the ground.
Yeah, so Rubio was stressing, like, keep your knees on the ground or keep your knees bent or something, right? Okay. So I do actually want to, because this is the fun part about politics sometimes, I do want to analyze this entire moment. Was this a gaffe? What does this mean for 2016, Michael? Was the spiral good? You know, what does this say about Marco Rubio? And would Obama have, like, done – why didn't Obama ever bean someone in the head playing basketball? Well, actually, Obama's not that good of a basketball player.
That's right.
He's not very good.
It did kind of remind me a bit of that video from a couple – years ago, maybe last year, where he's trying to make shots.
Yeah.
Obama is at the White House basketball court, and he takes like 30 before he knows. And as soon as he hits it, the camera zooms in on the thing, and then it zooms back over to Obama, and he's like walking. He's like, I'm out of here. it's done. I actually think it was
the thrill is gone, because, you know, during 08 he was in Iraq, and he was in front of a crowd of like soldiers in some gym, and he's like, it's going to take me a few minutes to like get a shot, and he like gets a three-pointer the first time. The thrill is gone, Michael. It's over.
The difference between being the candidate at the top of the heap and the second-term president with all of the weight of the presidency on your shoulders. So let's tune back in 6 years to President Marco Rubio throwing the football, and it's like wobbling in the air, or, you know, he's overthrowing or underthrowing. I think this kind of stuff is good for somebody like Rubio.
This is the argument I heard from some people yesterday, actually.
I think in all seriousness, it sort of does emphasize the youth factor. You know, you can't imagine it's kind of different because she's a woman, but you can't imagine Hillary Clinton sort of throwing the football around or doing something that sort of a younger candidate would be doing. So I think it does help him humanizes him a bit. I think sometimes Rubio can come across as like the class president.
Nice
young man.
Yeah, that's what I've always said. Like, Rubio feels like the popular captain of the football team with the cheerleader girlfriend, and his wife was actually a cheerleader. It does feel that way, that sort of like he's very – sometimes it feels like he's very sensitive to criticism and doesn't respond well. So go on. Sorry, I interrupt you.
I think I agree with that. So I think this is to see him. I mean, but you add to this, you know, the water thing and the State of the Union response. There's been a couple of times in his political career, at least at the national level, where he's had some slip ups. I'm trying to think. There was one more. It's escaping me right now. But I think it does humanize him and make him seem a little more flawed, which is good.
I think the everyman is throwing a football with kids and beans them in the head. But the difference is else's parents come screaming over and says, "Oh my God, you hurt my son! Don't ever fucking kill my son!"
I don't think that was the response.
Was not the response. That was not the response at all. Oh dear,
future president, bean my kid. That's awesome.
I mean, the thing is, the kid is going to be beat up relentlessly in high school as like the kid who couldn't catch a football for the rest of his life, or he's going to become the next president. You know, maybe he'll become a Democrat. One of the two.
Maybe. Yeah. You know, I've been taking hits from Republicans my life is what I'm saying. I really do think both of these videos just show the sort of challenges football recruiters at Iowa and Iowa State have. You know, I mean, these are the people they have to work with. You know, they can't catch a simple, easy spiral.
Are you a Big Ten alum, or where did you go to college?
No, I went to Vanderbilt. I'm an SEC guy.
Okay. I went to
not that Vanderbilt is like a is yeah, like a high performing.
I don't think
SEC
the Commodores
football.
Are going to the championship this year, are they? No, it's Commodores, right?
Can we move on? Is there another topic to move on from my alma mater here? Jeez.
I mean, hey, you know, if you ever want me to, what do you guys drink mint juleps and watch horse racing? I'm sure
that's Kentucky. I think, you know.
Well, I don't know what they do in Vanderbilt. I just picture like floppy hats and like, I don't know, some professor named Colonel Beauregard or something teaching a history class.
You know, it's a national school. It's left behind a lot of its Southern heritage.
I didn't say Southern. He could have been for the Union. I just feel like this is, I don't know. I don't know. My sister went to Harvard, and I give her shit about that too.
Where did you go?
I went to the University of Michigan. So we are the most maligned school because we're a pompous school in the Big Ten that doesn't do well at sports, and we're paying $7 million for this guy, Jim Harbaugh, to come and save the program. And there have been a lot of flattering profiles and stories about him, and I'm starting to think he's sort of in the Huntsman situation where he's just going to, like, flop. I think Jim Harbaugh, I hope we put a little clip here. I think Jim Harbaugh might be the John Huntsman of this football cycle.
Wow. That is I mean, every Michigan fan I follow and pay attention to is
they're
so excited about
because they don't. There's nowhere else to go, man. This is it. There's nothing else. This is it. This is like there's no one else. This is it. This is the program. Okay, so of course they're like this. Let's talk on game two. Okay, if Harbaugh doesn't win game one, trust me, Michigan fans will be singing a different tune. They'll be like, impeach him. You know, you can't even impeach a head coach, but they'll be doing that.
Well, it'd be interesting to follow that to see, you know, what, because you guys don't play football in the Big Ten. You play something else, something different than what
is that? Is that? Uh huh. Uh huh. Well, I think a Big Ten school won.
You know, there is a political tie.
I think. Wait, Michael. I think Ohio State won the whole thing last year. Is that right? I think that's true. I think that's.
Oh, wait a second. So I got a Michigan fan touting Ohio State. This is hard to believe. I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah.
Well, there is a Harbaugh connection to politics now. Yeah. I don't know if you saw Jim's brother, the coach of the Baltimore Ravens, praising Trump the other day.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, saying that you know, he's going to go Trump on everybody in the press conference he was giving, and then started talking about how the immigration plan for Trump is right on. So
John Harbaugh endorsed Donald Trump's immigration plan.
Yes, in fact,
I'm going to click on this, man.
Stranger things have happened in politics, but it's
goodness. I wanted to throw in my two cents. What did you think of the spiral of Marco Rubio's football throw?
It was okay. It was not great. It was not a perfect spiral. Uh-huh. It did wobble a bit. It was better, I think, than most of the candidates, Republican and Democrat, could have thrown.
I think you're right, man. Yeah. I think you're right. In the end, this does humanize him. This does allow the campaign to say, you know, Rubio played football in college, and people like that. He played at Tarkio.
He coaches
his kids Little League, which is adorable and wonderful. Yeah. And like you, it's hard not to like that.
I think the telling thing about this is that the Rubio campaign was sort of promoting this on. I saw, I'm ashamed to say, on their Snapchat story that this happened.
I was surprised. Let me say this. I was surprised with when I was writing this up and checking some facts, because even on these stories, you want to check like what day it was. I was surprised with the Rubio team being like, they weren't screaming. They weren't saying to me, why are you writing this fluff? They were just like, this is what happened. Right. I wasn't there. You know,
it's a good attitude to have.
It is a great attitude to have. I've ranted about this before, Michael, but like, and this is what I tell Flax, who work with me, just trust me, don't get angry at me. You know, don't get angry at reporters. It pays off. I mean, you're going to have good stories and bad stories, but like, you know, the press teams that like don't get angry and just keep going are the ones that help their bosses a lot more. Because we'll write what we write either way.
That's right. And it's got to be sort of a mutual respect kind of thing, and I sometimes struggle with the way I treat campaigns that have that sort of disrespect, it's not even disrespect, it's just like, look, we're all trying to do our jobs here. Right. Let's try to get along at least for the next couple of months or years.
It's 460 more days of this, guys. Get comfortable. All right? Right, there's no point in like burning bridges now, because we got a long way to go. Let's round out with John Kasich. You wrote a piece on John Kasich. I've been writing some stuff on John Kasich and Jeb Bush. And I wanted to like round this out with, so John Kasich recently, I think 2 days ago, announced the name of his state chair for South Carolina. He has the endorsement of Bob Bentley. And he's doing pretty well in New Hampshire. And he sort of inhabits the same sphere as Jeb Bush. What do you think of, I still don't quite know what to make of John Kasich, actually. What do you think? Do you think he has to worry about the southern states? Do you think he has any appeal there? And is he just like, is it, sooner or later, is Jeb just going to be like, he's becoming a problem and swat him away? Not that we've seen Jeb able to do that with 17 candidates
right
in the race so far.
Well, the comparison has been made by me and others that John Kasich is sort of the John Huntsman of the 2016 pack. He's got the same advisor in John Weaver.
And Fred Davis, the same ad maker.
That's right. That's a very good point. Both John McCain, 2008 alums. Weaver, in particular, seems to have a his modus operandi seems to be to work with candidates who will criticize Republicans and conservatives. I did argue in sort of Kasich's favor, because I think the Huntsman campaign is rightly seen as somewhat of a failure. Well, it was a failure. He didn't win. But he didn't even do that well.
I think there can be only one, but a big flop, right?
It was a big flop in New Hampshire. I argued this, that if Mitt Romney, if Jeb Bush is the Mitt Romney of this cycle and John Kasich is the John Huntsman of this cycle, Kasich is in a much better position vis-a-vis Bush than Huntsman was, because Romney's basically was in his home state, New Hampshire. Yeah. He lived there. He was governor of the state next door. It was his realm. Jeb Bush is really struggling in New Hampshire, I think. I've talked to Republicans who are wondering, like, what the hell is he doing there? Kasich's pack has been up with ads.
Yeah, they've been doing really well and way better than Huntsman did.
That's right. And I think he has an advantage. I think he's a little more likable than Huntsman. I remember following Huntsman around in 2012 in New Hampshire and being like, who's going to vote for this guy? And I was right. I mean, nobody did. He's a little dismissive.
He was great on, I mean, John Huntsman and John Kasich, I think, are exact opposites. From John Huntsman never lost a race. He only ran one. He ran twice. And did he win both times?
Yeah.
Okay. He won both times. Kasich has run for president, lost, and has been up and down. Kasich is this unpredictable personality. He can be very sort of gregarious and then kind of moody other times. John Huntsman is very even-keeled, very sort of polished. And they're complete opposites, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Huntsman's the scion of a huge sort of industrial giant, Huntsman Industries.
Kasich, the son of a mailman?
I've heard him say that once or twice, that he's the son of a mailman. And so he's gotten more blue-collar appeal. Kasich has a lot of problems with the Medicaid expansion. I think that is a real problem for him, because...
And his explanation, right, is that God, it's a religious... It's the right thing to do. It's related to, like, God or something.
Yeah, and he can be kind of a jerk. Look, Republicans are the sort of more, certainly the more religious on the Christian side of things, party. People who take their faith very seriously, whether it's conservative Catholics or evangelical Protestants, which make up the big part of it. And so it's not insane to sort of make appeals to God and faith, but it's not in a way that Republicans and conservatives and the small C conservatives, Christians, talk about it and think about it. And there's definitely a sort of move toward more, I wouldn't call it social justice aspects of the gospel, but there is definitely a more interest in helping people and that sort of thing in sort of political Christianity than perhaps there used to be. But I think Kasich kind of hits the wrong note there, and that's a problem for him. But, you know, the media loves him, and that's important for him and his candidacy.
Yeah.
And Jeb Bush is weak right now. I don't understand why Jeb Bush is not throwing up, or his PAC is not throwing up ads in New Hampshire right now. Why aren't they up
with ads? I don't know. And it's weird because Kasich's PAC started in late and has been very aggressive in New Hampshire, and he's doing pretty well there. And that's partially because of the aggressive media strategy they have there. It's really weird. On the other hand, I sort of get, I don't know. It is really strange why two of the top three tier one candidates, excluding Trump, who are sort of in this lying in wait position right now. So Rubio doesn't really have an early state, or maybe Nevada, maybe South Carolina.
Yeah.
And the same with Jeb, which is, he's not doing super well in New Hampshire, which you would think he'd want to do well in there. Iowa was supposed to be his like state once upon a time with David Kochel.
Kochel.
It's not doing super well there, but he's doing okay.
Let me say something about Jeb and Iowa, because and I think this goes to your larger point, is what are these top tier candidates doing right now? I talked to somebody, a veteran of Republican campaigns, who said that the Walker numbers, you know, in Iowa, actually not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
He's losing to Trump, big deal. I think we talked about that earlier in the program. He said the numbers that ought to be alarming, the only one who did badly in that Iowa poll, I think it was from Fox News, was Jeb Bush. He was at like 2%.
Yeah,
in Iowa. He said that's bad.
Yeah,
you don't maybe expect Jeb to win in Iowa when you've got someone like Scott Walker and Ted Cruz and others. But at 2%, really, really bad. It does not bode well for him. And you do have to wonder what the hell is going on, and why are they sitting on their hands? Rubio can say the same thing, although Rubio's not the front runner or in the money or in the polls. So he does have sort of, I think, a little more leeway. But this is why Walker's Obamacare proposal is should be encouraging to the Walker folks. Like the fact that it's sort of getting attention now is because I think primary voters are interested in knowing what you're going to do, and they want to start hearing about it now. Not everybody's going to read a white paper about healthcare reform,
No. But
they want to know that you're, you know, thinking about the future. Rubio, Jeb, you know, they've got to sort of speak to those issues starting now, lay a foundation right now, and you haven't quite heard that from them.
Yeah, I don't know. Rubio in Politico, did lay out a healthcare proposal sort of to compete with Walker. Same day.
That's right.
It was not quite as extensive as Walker's. And Walker, it seemed like a counter punch more than like an actual sort of move by Rubio in its own right. More sort of just a response to Walker. I don't know. I think the forward-leaning candidate in the end, forward-looking candidate, is the one that people are going to like, which leads me back to a question that I want to ask you. I covered the Huntsman campaign in 12 for The Hill. You've written about Huntsman a lot. Should Huntsman have run this time instead of last time? Or was it his personality, that sort of sanguine nature, that sort of DC appeal that really did him in? Because I go back and forth on this. On the one hand, I'm sort of like, you know, if Huntsman had run now and been sort of this polished candidate, maybe, but like at the same time, like saying Chinese in the middle of a debate, a lot of these like moves to humanize him didn't come off very well. And I think Huntsman had won too much in his life. Americans like people who have lost, and Huntsman has a beautiful family. He's rich, went to the University of Pennsylvania. He just wins. All he does is win. That's not relatable. Every presidential nominee in modern history has lost some. We are a country that needs to know that the guy we're backing knows what it's like to lose sometimes.
Right.
And I feel like at the core, that's the problem that Huntsman did in. He's just things have gone too well for him.
Yeah, I don't see Huntsman running this time around, but should he have?
Not, I don't see him running either.
No. I mean, I don't sort of see him in our alternative universe instead of 12. Remember, he was he was in the Obama administration as the ambassador to China. He had left the governorship, which was a fairly conservative governorship, but it's also Utah, which is a very conservative state.
Yeah.
I think that's important to know what he was doing in 2009 and in 2010. And it goes to, I think, some of Jeb's problems as well, which is that since really 2010, when Scott Brown won the election, took the special election in the Senate, since then, Republicans have been fighting some real, very real issues. They've been fighting on Obamacare. They've been fighting on sort of the government spending and the stimulus, some of the climate change initiatives that Democrats have been pushing. They've been pushing now a lot more recently on national security. There's all these battles that Republicans have been waging, and you can make the case that a bunch of these different candidates have been part of those battles.
Mm-hmm.
Huntsman really wasn't, and I think Jeb really wasn't either. I've heard this criticism from Chris Christie. In fact, Christie says, I went around in 2014 to elect a bunch of governors, you know, who were dealing with issues that are happening right now in the country, because I didn't see Jeb much. Ultimately, right now, yes, Republicans are going to be looking for the forward-looking candidate, but the record and the sort of those candidates have been doing in the Obama era, or in what those candidates have been doing to sort of advance conservative ideas, new forward thinking proposals, that's what people are going to be paying attention to. And that's a problem for Jeb. And I think it would have been a problem for Huntsman as well. And it kind of speaks to, I think, this divide among voters and the kind of frustrations that are channeled into someone like Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think I definitely buy that. And listen, you know, it's becoming a cliche, but I think Donald Trump does really appeal to a portion of the electorate who really want he speaks to them. He's singing a song that they find appealing, and they feel that no other candidate has to offer. So there is that. That's it. I've got nothing. I was going to close out, Michael, unless you've got a closing point here today.
I just have one closing point on Donald Trump, since I'm amazed that we haven't, this whole conversation has not been dominated by him. It's weird for me to not talk about 2016 and not just be all
Trump. I mean,
Trump's
what
time.
Else is there to say?
Exactly. Well, but I do want to say this final thought on Trump, which is relates to the other candidates, which is Trump is problematic in a lot of ways for Republicans. He's speaking, I think, to a group of people who feel disaffected within the party and without the party. This has always been, to me, the Trump phenomenon has been, in many ways, a failing of the Republican candidates to offer a forward-looking agenda that speaks to these issues and realizes that the party and the country have changed in the last 2, 4, 6, 8 years.
Right.
I don't think there's stomach in the party for comprehensive immigration reform. That's something that the party sort of bosses or whatever haven't figured out. The crappy situation of the economy has not made that element of sort of comprehensive immigration reform, of letting more people in to the country, all that appealing to Republican voters or to blue collar voters and the type of people that Republicans depend on. I think it's Republicans, these candidates have not yet stepped up. They're starting to, have not yet stepped up though to the plate and offered something real. And so that's why you're seeing Trump kind of come in and his sort of pull it together, jury-rigged kind of view of these issues is what's taking off. It's a failed opportunity, a missed opportunity, but there's still some time for these candidates to grab it.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I think it's a long way, and sooner or later, what's likely is that one of these 17 candidates, or 16, if you don't include Trump, will finally figure it out and say, let's just try this, and that'll take off, maybe. I don't know. I think the winnowing when it happens and when these candidates start to drop out, I think we're going to see a few things change, not only with the campaigns that are gone, but the campaigns that stay in the race. And maybe that is what Jeb and Marco are really waiting for. Yeah. All right. Well, Michael, this was fun. This is even more fun than I thought it would be. It was great having you. So I look forward to your next piece. Keep rocking. I will talk to you later.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. All right. Thanks.